Dr. Brendan Riley is the Gladys and Roland Harriman Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, also serves as Executive Vice Chair of Medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Although he's gotten to know many of his patients over the course of his 40-year career, few know his story, what he calls his lifelong affair with medicine. In his book, One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine, he writes about the challenges facing both doctors and patients in a time when medicine is becoming increasingly depersonalized and driven by business. It's published by Atria Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Dr. Brendan Riley to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
Most of this book takes place as you make rounds over the course of 2 weeks in the winter of 2010, but you also write about the larger medical issues surrounding the cases of patients that you treated during that time. Did something happen during these weeks that made you realize that you wanted to write about your career?
I think what was special about it was that when I looked back on those 2 weeks, what had happened was not just my dealing with a lot of fascinating patients at Cornell and New York Presbyterian, but during those same 2 weeks, I had to deal with the life-threatening illnesses of both of my parents, both of whom were 90, and for reasons we either can discuss or not, didn't have a doctor. And I became my parents' doctor. And during those two
Isn't
weeks...
Isn't that discouraged, usually, the
it's
doctors
a very,
treating the... members of their families?
Yeah, it's a very dumb idea. In my case, though, my parents actually were living on Shelter Island, which is off the end of Long Island, and at the time, Shelter Island didn't have any doctors, and the doctors on the mainland didn't come to the island, and because they were both ill and both very elderly and pretty much homebound because, again, they were 90, I actually, by default, became their doctor. I didn't have much choice.
So you were doing something doctors haven't done since I was a kid, which was making house calls.
Well, actually, I'm not sure how long ago you were a kid, because actually the middle of my book is actually a flashback to about 25 years ago when I did a whole different kind of medicine in rural New England. And there I did a lot of house calls. And actually, house calls were probably among my most memorable professional experience. I think it's a fantastic thing for both patients and doctors, but lots of young doctors never have done one and maybe never will.
Well, you may have been doing them in rural New England, but less likely in Brooklyn, which is where I grew up. But that's a whole other story, but maybe it is part of this story. Why weren't your parents moved to a place where there were doctors?
Well, they actually had spent their working lives in Manhattan, and when they retired in their 60s, they made the real estate deal of the century on a place on Shelter Island and moved there, and they loved being there. You know, they became a part of the community, and yet that... unfortunately meant that our, quote, medical care system, which if you're really interested in systems, probably doesn't exist in the United States. There is no system if two 90-year-old, well-insured people have a problem getting access to a doctor.
Now, I mentioned that the framework of this book is these 2 weeks, but you do have flashbacks in which you talk about being a primary care physician in that small town in New England.
Yep.
Because you wanted to contrast the way medicine used to be practiced and the way it's practiced today?
Yes. Also, because most of the book is based here in New York in a very fine, high-tech hospital, New York Presbyterian, where in general you're taking care of very sick patients, many of them quite elderly, who are facing all kinds of difficult decisions. And I did the flashback to New England also to show this other side of medicine, which is not just in high-tech hospitals, but happens obviously in doctor's offices and outpatient settings.
When did doctors also start spending time in hospitals as a matter of normal practice?
Well, you know, it used to be that patients would have a doctor who took care of them wherever they were, whether it was in their office or sometimes at home. And if they were sick enough to have to be in the hospital, quotes, your doctor, your one doctor, which is why the book is called One Doctor, your one doctor would take care of you there. About 15 years ago, the economics of medicine became such that it turned out to be not economically viable for that model to continue. And so now we have upwards of, I think it's probably up to 40,000 doctors in the United States now who work only in hospitals, only taking care of sick patients, and they don't take care of these patients before they come in the hospital, and they never see them again after they leave the hospital.
Now, are we talking about the old-fashioned version, the primary care hospital doctor? That's also what we would call an internist today?
Well, many internists.
A GP?
Well, it used to be called a GP back in the days before primary care doctors were divided among specialties like internal medicine, pediatrics, family medicine, that sort of thing. And so it used to be that patients having a primary care doctor was routine. Many folks still have primary care doctors, but the role of the primary care doctor has changed. And part of the reason I'm uncomfortable with that is often the bond that develops between a doctor and a patient happens when the patient faces tough times and you kind of go through a difficult time together. And if your primary care doctor isn't even there when you're in the hospital and somebody else is taking care of you, that interferes with that relationship.
There are other problems. I can speak from personal experience. I had a very nice relationship with a doctor who then started working at a hospital in hours, the only hours that I could see him.
Yes.
So I had to move on to another doctor, not because I was unhappy with him or he was unhappy with me, but simply because every time I called to make an appointment, I couldn't see him.
Yes. And again, for dinosaurs like me, the doctors didn't used to work that way. There wasn't this sort of shift work mentality, which has a lot of justification for it. You know, young people who go into medicine today also want to have a life. I understand that. But I think a lot of people who are not in medicine don't understand the impact that this is having on their care. It's become very fragmented.
Well, what changes in medicine have caused internists to become extinct?
Well, internists aren't extinct. There's lots of us.
But now they're hospitalists, specialists, proceduralists.
Yeah, right. The kind of internist I grew up to be are becoming extinct. That's definitely true. Internal medicine, though, for folks who don't know, includes many different subspecialties related to each organ system of the body. So cardiologists, oncologists, pulmonologists, these are all people who are internists first, and then they become subspecialized beyond that. In the old days, an internist was somebody who did all that stuff. So the fact that this has become more fragmented and more subspecialized in some ways is good because it means that medicine has advanced so much recently that one doctor can't possibly do everything for patients.
But also, don't primary care doctors earn less money than specialists?
Much less.
And so if I go to medical school today, and somebody says, oh, we need more primary care doctors, I'd say, well, yeah, but I want to make some decent money.
Right. So if you're a kid, I call them kids, and they're in your late 20s and you've just finished medical school and you're already a couple of $100,000 in debt and somebody gives you a choice, would you like to be a primary care doctor and see patients 60 hours a week and make X amount of dollars, or would you like to have a 9-to-5 job as a radiologist or a dermatologist and make 5 times as much? Chances are most of them, these are smart people, will probably choose the latter. That needs to be fixed. That needs to change.
Brendan Riley is Executive Vice Chair of Medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital and Gladys and Roland Harriman Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. He has published widely, and his most recent work is a book called One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. It's published by Atria Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Brendan Riley. His book, One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine, published by Atria Books. You were profiled at length in Malcolm Gladwell's 2005 bestseller, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, which suggests that spontaneous decisions are just as good as or even better than planned ones. How did you become involved in that project?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Malcolm Gladwell was actually looking for the flip side of that hypothesis at the same time. He was looking for examples of where maybe instinct alone, gut decisions aren't better than some alternative. And so he was looking.
And sometimes they aren't better.
Absolutely. And so he was looking for some examples in medicine, and he found me because I at the time was working in Chicago at a very large, busy hospital where we had implemented a way to try to help doctors make tough decisions about patients in the emergency room who might be having heart attacks. This was based on research that had been published by Lee Goldman, who's now the dean of Columbia Medical School. And basically, it allows doctors to do what they normally do, but also to base their decision largely on evidence that's been collected about what are the key things you must find out about these patients to make the right decisions for them. And that was an example that Gladwell found of where, well, just using a doctor's gut judgment sometimes is not as good at using strong scientific evidence to be the foundation. And then beyond that, certainly the doctor has to exercise judgment as well.
The checklist that people are now talking about.
It's similar to that.
Are patients often misdiagnosed as suffering from a heart attack when they're actually suffering from something else?
Yeah, one of the remarkable things about the epidemic of heart disease in the United States is we're doing a fantastic job of reducing mortality from coronary heart disease. We've reduced it in half in the past generation. But the fallout from that is we're testing an awful lot of people who have symptoms that are superficially similar to a heart attack that have nothing to do with their heart. And that's why so many people wind up in emergency rooms getting all kinds of expensive tests, which frankly they don't need, because there is this concern about missing even one heart attack among the many thousands that we see.
I used to work with a man who had a hiatal hernia, and they thought he had a heart attack.
Every
is that typical?
Every time, yeah. But everything from heartburn to muscle strain to panic attacks can cause symptoms that sound a lot like a heart attack.
So what was the old procedure for diagnosing heart attacks, and why was it a problem?
In the old days, meaning up until about 20 years ago, the most common diagnosis for patients admitted to American hospitals was something called ROMI, R-O-M-I, which means rule out MI, or myocardial infarction. And patients would actually stay in the hospital for 2 or 3 days going through a whole bunch of tests to make sure that they did not have a heart attack. Now we have ways to do this quicker, usually in the emergency room.
Using an algorithm?
Well, most ERs and most doctors don't use the kind of algorithm that Malcolm Gladwell was talking about in Blink. And there are all kinds of interesting reasons why that is true, even though there's very strong evidence, including some that we published ourselves in Chicago, showing that it helps and it makes a difference. In general, doctors are not big fans of algorithms. Most of them tend to call this, quote, cookbook medicine. They don't like the idea that somebody's telling them that something can be as simple as just following a little checklist.
They prefer that doctor's intuition, the gut reaction. I see this person. I know right away that this is whatever.
Well, I think it's partly that. It's also partly, wait a second, I've been doing medicine for 20 or 30 years, and I think I know some things, and don't tell me that some little checklist of 3 or 4 things is going to help me. I already know that stuff, and I know better.
But what often happens is they follow certain instincts and ignore other things. I know somebody who had endometriosis who was misdiagnosed as having PID for years, wound up in two hospitals as a result. Nobody ever bothered to check to see if she had a bacterial infection.
Yes. And so, of course, that kind of thing happens all the time in medicine. Medicine is pretty complicated, and even though in general we do a pretty good job, doctors make mistakes all the time. And so some of the research that's been done tries to acknowledge the fact that no doctors are perfect. We all need a little bit of help. And in spite of how smart we think we are and can trust our gut instinct, there are definitely ways that using evidence in a systematic way can help.
One of the patients you write about who you saw on your shift, Mr. Atkins, had liver cancer and goes into comatose state due to a severe case of hypoglycemia. He could have died.
Absolutely.
Tina, an intern, beats herself up over the mistake. Is it normal for doctors to feel guilty about their errors despite the fact that the medical profession now views errors in medicine as system flaws, not character flaws?
Well, it is common for doctors to feel guilty about it. It's not common for doctors to talk about it. And there probably is a great need for that to happen because most of us are carrying around a lot of baggage about the things that we either didn't do and wish we had or vice versa. And so the whole issue about medical error is getting better because doctors and hospitals are trying harder to be more transparent about this. But we still got a long way to go.
Well, the system can't always take personal responsibility for errors, especially when a spouse or a family member is angry over the mistake, as Mrs. Atkins was.
Yeah.
When you were when you run a program, do you encourage new doctors to be mindful of their accountability?
Of course you do. That doesn't mean it's easy to do. And I would say, in general, the quote system, the system does not encourage that. So you're a little bit against the tide when you're trying to do this. But ultimately, I think it's a very important thing to do.
Well, is it easy for some doctors to become desensitized to sickness and the possibility of death?
Absolutely. And I think in some ways this results from natural defense mechanisms when you're doing this kind of work, and especially if you're working in the hospital where you're dealing with folks who are facing very tough situations all the time, and you move from one case to the next, it's pretty easy to get desensitized.
On the other hand, some people just don't want to deal with the failure. A friend who had cancer felt suddenly abandoned by her oncologist. Once it was determined that the cancer was no longer curable, the oncologist suddenly disappeared, and she felt that she'd had this relationship with the oncologist. I guess the oncologist felt, well, there's nothing I can do anymore, so let me move on.
Well, that's an example of a patient who does not have one doctor, the kind I think all of us should have, who follows you no matter what happens, and not just when the particular specialty of that doctor is involved. But it's also an example of a doctor who has not assumed the role of one doctor who will try to help you, even if, for example, in this case, the treatment of the cancer is not going to help. The patient still can get help from that doctor, even if it's not chemotherapy or radiation therapy.
Aren't patients spending less time in hospitals these days? Is this a matter of economics or because we're doing practicing better medicine?
Hospitals are now paid for the diagnosis, regardless of how long the patient stays in the hospital. Before that was true, patients would stay in the hospital for many more days than they do today because the financial incentives are such that it is to the hospital's advantage to get the patient in and out of the hospital as quickly as possible because they receive a fixed fee.
Why doesn't educating patients about unnecessary medical procedures like annual mammograms, prostate exams, and the overuse of antibiotics getting more traction in the United States?
I think it's getting traction, but I think it's highly controversial. That kind of gets at the issue about patients' expectations. So there are many patients who are absolutely convinced that those kinds of tests are essential. They've read that, they've learned that, and yet when you look at the medical evidence about things like, for example, mammograms in young, healthy, low-risk women, there are an awful lot of young, healthy, low-risk women who are absolutely certain that having an annual mammogram is essential to their health. And there's a lot of controversy about whether that's really true.
But then there are people who are concerned that doctors are willing to perform those procedures. Just recently saw a thing about plastic surgery where women are getting this thing that makes them look like they're smiling.
Yeah.
I can't imagine any doctor who has any sense of responsibility performing that procedure.
I must say I agree with you.
But they do. So is this simply a matter of the money involved?
It is. But, you know, medicine is a huge operation. There are lots of different parts of medicine. So, for example, cosmetic surgery is one tiny part of medicine, which I think actually ought to be commoditized. It is an example of where a patient says, you know, I want to look better. Can you make me look better? And it'll cost you $10,000, and if you want to pay the bill, go right ahead. The problem, I think, as I see it, is that that sort of commoditization of medicine is leaking into all of the other kinds of medicine that we do, where patients more and more are thinking, you know, you just, if you want it, you buy it. And the craziness about this, of course, is that most patients don't pay cash for it. Insurers pay for it. And then you get into the whole politics of healthcare insurance and who's responsible for what.
There are a lot of medical shows on television, and the TV show ER was conceived and filmed during the time you were at Cook County Hospital in Chicago. Did patients come in and tell you that They knew they had a certain condition based on what they'd seen on television. How do you go against the popular culture?
It was even more fun than that. I had patients I would see in the ER and the ER in Cook County Hospital, and after we'd finished, and hopefully they were better when we were getting ready to send them home, they seemed very disappointed. And when I asked them why they were disappointed, it turned out they expected George Clooney to be the doctor who'd be taking care of them in the ER. And I wasn't George Clooney, and so even though I think we took pretty good care of them, they still weren't happy.
So if I were somebody who just got out of medical school today, would I be facing different challenges than you would have when you came out 40 years ago? People are still getting sick and to the same illnesses they did 40 years ago, aren't they?
They are, although luckily there are so many fantastic things that have happened in medical science. There are so many things we can do for patients today that we could never do when I was younger. And so that's the plus side. The downside is that in order to help patients figure out what's best for them, what they need, again, they need somebody they can count on who knows them, who they trust, to give them good advice. Because without that, what I call one doctor, that's why the book is called that, without that person, you're really bumped from one specialist to another, in the hospital, out of the hospital. Some people have made the analogy, this is like a great symphony orchestra trying to play great music without a conductor. There needs to be someone who is actually overseeing the patient's care as the patient goes from one venue and one doctor to another.
Are doctors, older doctors, able to keep up with all of the changes in medical technology and treatments?
That's a really good question. I think most try. I think most do. There's a lot of interesting research, though, about what it takes first to become an expert in anything, including medicine, and then what it takes to remain an expert. And there are some people who think that as doctors begin to reach an age like mine, that maybe you begin to tail off and aren't as good as you used to be. There are others who vociferously disagree with that and say that you just keep getting better the longer you go and the more you practice.
Well, one of the problems for many patients is their doctors will just tell them, do it because I tell you to do it, rather than because they've given them any good reason to do it.
And I think that still goes on. I think, luckily, that is changing. I think more and more patients are trying to become informed and trying to speak up for themselves. But, again, that's not enough. It's naive to think that just a well-informed patient can solve these problems.
Brendan Riley's book is One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. It is published by Atria Books. And Dr. Riley will be giving a reading and signing books at the Corner Bookstore tonight at 6. That's at Madison Avenue and 93rd Street. Thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure.